AIEA Podcasting presents The Pale. Episode 1, The Journalist.
I know what you're thinking, but I promise we are not in the Bermuda Triangle. We're not even close. Some people opt for tropical cruises, but we went on one to the Antarctic. I swore I'd never go on a cruise. I don't like being in crowds of people. I don't like being stuck in one location. I don't like buffets of any kind. I didn't have a choice. My name is Art Rosenblatt. And while you might not recognize my name, you probably would recognize my wife's. The Honorable Rachel Gutierrez, of Illinois, Democrat, of course. So yeah, being the husband of a US senator means vacations are tricky. We can't travel to half the states in America because it will be seen as the first step in a presidential campaign. And we can't travel to the other half because it wouldn't help her presidential campaign. Which, mind you, doesn't exist. It's just that if it did, it wouldn't help. International travel is not much better. Going to Europe doesn't play well with male voters age 40 to 90. Asia doesn't play well with female voters ages 35 to 60. South American trips are yada, 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 yada. You get it. So, Antarctica, the least political place on the planet. Still required 2 weeks of research before her chief of staff okayed us. Cruise lines was what they came up with. I don't know how. I'm an investigative journalist, and I could barely find out anything about them. The first mention of them in any paper of record is in 1988. In an article about a man who claims to have an illicit affair with a Reagan daughter. Then they were name-dropped in a lawsuit about shrimp suppliers, a psychiatric journal with an article about hallucinations during Arctic summer, a travel blog, a few social posts, that kind of thing. Nothing that told me anything substantive about the company. I told Rachel I didn't like it, that it gave me a bad feeling. She just said I didn't like not knowing everything. Which is arguable. We always promise we won't bring work with us on vacation, and it's one of those promises which we both break. And confronting the other about would lead to mutually assured destruction. Our jobs are so incompatible for a marriage as it is that maintaining the relationship requires a fair bit of ignoring reality. This time, though, I really didn't mean to work. Did I bring my mic? Yes. To be fair, I pack a dozen things I never actually think I'll use, just that I'd rather have and not use than need and not have. But when Q went missing for 26 hours, 53 minutes, and 58 seconds, things changed. Q is my kid. I'll tell you, they're older than 5, but younger than 12, and that's all you're getting. I know you can look it up, but I'm asking you to back off, okay? It started on the third day at sea. The first day was family time, doing activities together, getting to know the ship, that kind of thing. The second day, a little bit more of the same, and, well, after 2 days of that, my wife convinced me to leave the kids with the playgroup. I'm a stay-at-home dad between freelance gigs, so I may be prone to a little separation anxiety. But when my wife told me about the bottle of tequila she had liberated from the wet bar, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to relive our college years. Note to self, remember to edit that last part out. Okay, so where was I? Right, how it all happened. Neither my wife nor myself still has the body of a college undergrad anymore, apparently, so when the kids left, it wasn't long until we fell asleep. Her laptop was open and still auto-playing whatever we had fallen asleep to, I forget. I woke up at 3:14 p.m. Strong need to go to the bathroom, which once I did, you know, I didn't feel like I could go back to sleep because it was, again, 3:14 in the afternoon. So I wandered out and looked for the commissary to grab a snack. I felt each movement of the ship and the corridors felt like an endless carnival maze. When I finally arrived at the door I thought led to the commissary, it was locked, and you know, I tried again. This time it opened, so I guess, you know, wasn't actually locked. But the room was dark. It took a few pulls of the light cord for me to see that I was actually in some kind of storage room. Turned the light off and I left. At this point, my head was starting to clear, but I still had no idea where I was. Everything on the ship looks the same, so I couldn't tell if my surroundings were familiar or alien. All I could do was try to retrace my steps. Rachel would make fun of me for not just getting drunk, but getting lost. But I tried my best to navigate and kept going. Instead of getting back to the cabin, I found myself at the daycare on the ship where I left the kids off. They had all the kids sleeping on these mats for nap time. When I opened the door, I was determined to ask for directions, but I remember thinking, if this playgroup is for kids 5 to 12, why are they all napping, right? Anyway, so I went in. The crew member in charge didn't look up from her book. When I came up to her, it took almost a minute of urgently but silently waving at her to get her attention. I whispered that I was lost and needed help back. She just gave me a look and told me I couldn't be here. And I told her, still whispering, that I had 3 kids here. She asked which. Looking into the rows of dozing children, I quickly found the twins, who I pointed out. She asked about the 3rd. I turned back to find Q, but I couldn't. The next few hours I don't remember. All I know is that after I noticed Q was missing, I started yelling. I fainted, and then I was sitting down with my wife in an office while a man in a yellow vest was talking to her. It was a big ship. Kids wander off. There's nowhere she could have gone. They were looking. I don't know. The usual. The kind of words that didn't mean anything, but that were supposed to make you feel better because someone in a position of authority was talking to you. Rachel was asking questions nonstop, but it didn't do any good. There were security cameras, but it was a big ship. He said the footage did show that no one had been in the hallways, but they couldn't see anyone leave the play center. To her credit, Rachel doesn't play the senator card that often, but she did now. Didn't do any good. To them, we were just 2 hysterical parents whose credibility was quickly disappearing as they realized we had only recently sobered up. Eventually, I left with the twins to go back to the cabin, but Rachel would not be moved. She wanted to make sure that they were taking this seriously, and I wasn't going to fight her. Later, after things got really strange, I would ask her about what happened in the security offices. She shrugged and told me she didn't know much. They wouldn't talk to her. Anytime they were close, the security officers would whisper, and as often as not, they'd just move their conversation to the brig. At one point, she got up, made as if to go to the water cooler, but took a detour to try to listen to the conversation. Best she could tell, they were speaking in Icelandic or something like that. And even that stopped when they noticed that she was watching them. Apparently, after that, she soon just passed out on the folding chairs in the security office. And then was woken up when a woman in a security vest came in holding what looked like a bundle of blankets. She told Rachel she had someone to see her. And when the security officer moved the blanket, there was Q. After lots of tears, Rachel asked the woman where they'd found Q, and she said Sector 159. But when Rachel asked what that was, the security chief interrupted with a burst of laughter. He sidled up next to her and said that was a pantry where they kept snacks. He said something like, "Oh, wasn't she on quite a little adventure? Must have stuffed her face with cookies. I don't know. Something like that." Anyways, once Rachel came back, I was just too relieved to ask any of that at the time. It was hard. I had spent the day alone with two twins who were less concerned about where their sibling and mother were and more concerned about why they weren't allowed out of the room. So after we were all finally together, it was evening by then, and so we had dinner, got an early night's sleep. Over the next 2 days, we did end up leaving the room. Even got some fresh Antarctic air, but we stayed together. I tried talking to Q about what happened, but they were much more concerned about drawing than they were about answering any of my questions. I asked what they were drawing. The response I got was "Mama," but looking at the drawing, it looked like a paisley pattern stretched out over a spiral, melting with some haphazard crayon collection of colors. "This doesn't look like Mama," I told Q. Q thought about this for a second and told me in this extremely serious tone that I will never forget, "No, it's what Mama is." My first reaction was to text my parents to see if I had said anything this weird when I was Q's age, but then I realized that I would have to fess up about losing their grandchild for over 24 hours, and then explain why I didn't tell them, so I tried to put it aside. And I think I would have gotten over it if that were the last of the strangeness. The morning after the coloring incident, I woke up to see Rachel on the cabin couch watching the news. When I asked where the kids were, she said she'd dropped them off at the daycare. I didn't want to overreact, but I probably did. I asked her how she could do that after they lost our kids just a few days before. I was ready to get into this whole fight, preparing to lecture her on how she always just assumed the kids would be taken care of, but it was me who was taking care of them, and I didn't want to be the only one worrying about these things. To hear her say how she was their mother and gave birth to them, and she's got every right to make decisions too, and just all that. But she just looked out the window at the ice and rocks and water. I was about to say something, but she turned back around and said, "They're fine." Any further heated remark I had after that fell on deaf ears. It was like we were having two different conversations. I left the cabin, found the nearest crew member to take me to the daycare. Peeking in through the window, I saw them, all accounted for. Q was having a tea party with one of the twins, and the other twin was leafing through a picture book. They were fine. I went back to the cabin. I apologized to Rachel for getting upset. Not that I was wrong to worry, just that I flew off the handle a bit there. She understood. We had a lovely day. Finally, just the two of us. And for a little while, it felt normal. She picked the kids up from daycare. We had dinner. Went to a lecture one of the resident scientists gave on emperor penguins. Gave the kids some screen time. Tucked them in for bed. It was close to midnight when Rachel and I were turning in for the night. And I heard music coming from the kids' room. I opened the door, ready to bust them for unapproved screen time. But they were asleep. The tablet was in its charging dock. Turned off. At that point, I was still ready, even eager, to brush it off and forget the whole thing. Before I left the room, though, Q woke up and spoke to me. "It's a good thing you have the microphone, Daddy." I turned back to look, but Q was already curling up into sleeping position. I asked why they said that, but got non-committal responses back. I let Q drift back to sleep. What was so weird about this particular interjection was, on the surface, it seemed pretty normal. Q wasn't speaking in tongues, didn't have that weird tone of voice when I asked about the picture, and turning it over, I couldn't find any obvious strangeness to what they said. But everything had been weird since they disappeared. I mean, not every second and every little event. There was this pervasive weirdness that stretched across the days, in addition to particular moments of strangeness. I thought back on it all, this time with a critical viewpoint, trying to sort things out. And I remembered something. The chief of security, the first person we spoke to after Q disappeared, when he was talking about the video footage, he said there hadn't been anyone in the hallways. Not that there was no one outside the hallway in front of the play center, but that there was no one in the hallways. Plural. I thought back to that day, and yes, my brain was foggy, but there had been no one in the hallways. When I was trying to find my way around the ship, I didn't come across a single person. It was weird. The next day, I started talking to people. There are some settings where introducing yourself as a journalist actually makes people want to talk to you, and apparently this was one of those. I asked where they were 3:14 the day that Q disappeared. Most couldn't remember, but some could. Every single person who could account for their whereabouts at 3:14 that day said the same thing. They were asleep. It wasn't long after I had started asking around that people came to me with their own questions. I remembered what Q said. I started recording.
The Pale was written, recorded, and edited by Zev Hurwicz. The part of Art Rosenblatt was played by Zev Hurwicz. The Pale is an IEA podcasting production. To learn more about The Pale, or to find other great shows, go to IEA's website at aeaea.co.